Hanging out with the other Orla was like boot camp. You'd be climbing walls, building obstacle courses. She was gladiatorial. In primary school, she was good at running, could beat all the boys. But by the time we were in secondary, she was serious about swimming. She went to the pool in town every morning and was away at the weekends, winning medals. Hormones hit me before they hit the other Orla. She would have been happy with scuffed knees a while longer, but I dragged her into the mire. We both had crushes on Dave, and crushes doesn't cut it. We were obsessed with him. We wrote each other notes in class about his hair and eyes. We made up a song. We knew what actresses he fancied, what music he was into. We knew his star sign, his rising sign, his Chinese zodiac. We could recite his phone number, though we'd never called it. And we knew things Dave wouldn't have wanted us to know. Like, he studied, but pretended he didn't. He'd a thing for Miss McGreevy. He rubbed the back of his neck when he was nervous. He liked to be helpful and he hated to lose. We'd chemistry and Irish with Dave and we were always inventing excuses to speak to him, analysing the resulting interactions. Then, one spring day of leaving Sir Tir, something miraculous happened. Dave walked over to our desk, asked the other Orla if her Bunsen burner was working, and invited us to his mam's 50th birthday. "You know my mam," he said. We did know his mam. "It's her birthday, not this Saturday, the one after, and I've to invite four friends, but they can't all be boys because she says there's nothing festive about 17-year-old boys. That's a joke, like, so I've to invite two girls, but mam doesn't like Siobhan and Emma. Don't tell them." We would not tell them. "And she likes ye," she says, "maybe because you're the Orlas, like, you've a gimmick. Jarlath and Shocks are coming. I don't know if it'll be any good. You probably have swimming." His palm threatened to erode him from scalp to shoulder. Orla said there was no swimming, and I said we'd ask our parents. We let Dave light the Bunsen burner and carried out our desalination experiment with quaking hearts. The other Orla said he'd invited us because he liked me, and I said he'd invited us because he liked the other Orla. The night of the party, she wore an elegant black dress belonging to her mother, and I hated her for it. The Allens were well off, but their house wasn't showy from the road. It was just a normal enough house, nicely painted, tidy looking. Orla and I had last been there when Dave turned 6. We remembered art that took up a whole wall. Wood floors before everyone got wood floors. But it was the back garden that was most profoundly impressed on our imaginations. It was like something from an English country house turned spa. The patio was all tall plants, wicker-woven furniture, Buddha statues. There was a gravel path, a fire pit, and the most astonishing adornment of all was revealed when the conservatory doors pulled back, a warm, clean smell rose up, and you realised that the Allens had an honest-to-Jesus swimming pool. Dave's mam met us at the door, made a fuss of our presence. Dave stood behind her, hand on neck. She ushered us through to the kitchen and introduced us to tippling adults, who all got a kick out of the gimmick. "But which beautiful Orla is Dave's girlfriend?" asked an uncle. Orla and I giggled. Dave turned purple. "Come on," he said. "Jarlath and Shocks are here already." Back to the open conservatory doors, framed against geometric landscaping, Jarlath and Shocks were sitting, skinny in their trunks, feet in the pool, drinking beer. Adults were dotted in polite congregations on the patio outside. "Show us a swimming trick there, Orla," said Shocks or Jarlath. "She's not a seal," said Dave. "Do you know fancy dives or anything, no?" Jarlath or Shocks persisted. Orla shook her head, shy. How many lengths could you do without coming up for air? Asked Shock Sir Jarlath. The pool was maybe half the size of the one in town. Orla surveyed it. 9 or 10, she said. Dave looked sceptical. Show us. We'd our swimsuits under our clothes, so Orla took off her heels and zipped down the black dress. The boys stared, and adult men tried not to, until she slipped into the water. My makeup, though, she said, gliding to the shallow end. She disappeared into the medium in which she was mythic, an arrow of sinew, a minnow glinting, everyone watching the sprint of her body, the flick of her tail, once, twice, three times, four, look at, jeez, is she, that's a me, till surfacing, gasping, back of her hand across the eyes to open them, mascara streaked, victorious, and still, here was the clincher, still shy. I looked at Dave. He was barely breathing. By school on Monday, they were together, climbing trees like kids, kissing in the branches like not kids. I could have told you she'd mess it up. Just after exams, a bunch of us signed on for lifeguard training. It'd look well on our CVs. And a summer being paid to hang out at the pool in town sounded all right. Everyone took it seriously. There were no jokes about shifting the CPR dummy, no slagging Dara Sullivan for his swollen nipples. And even Siobhan, who, mostly to piss off her mam, didn't shave, escaped the social critiques of Jarlath and Shocks. The instructor, Nick, was a college man home for the summer. He wore an engagement ring and was purported to be marrying a Trinity med student. We all wanted to impress him, especially Siobhan, who thought a fella with an engagement ring was almost as revolutionary as her legs. It was my turn to play drowning victim and Dave's to demonstrate the front approach. He spun me face up and got the rescue tube past my shoulders. Then he had to swim a length supporting my head. This part, he wasn't landing. My nose was submerged most of the time. I snuck breaths whenever I surfaced and just about made it. How did that feel, Orla? Asked Nick. Good, I said. Dave smiled at me. It looked like your chin was low, Nick said. I don't think so, I replied. Nice job, Dave, said Nick. I caught Orla's eye. You cannot still be playing this game, it said. Next day, Orla was the dummy, and Dave made the same mistake. Before he could swim his length, she wriggled free. My nose was underwater, she said. Try again, called Nick from the tower. Same maneuver, same result, same protest. Maybe with the belt lower, said Orla, treading water. Annoyance flicked across Dave's face. I had it yesterday, he said. His form less confident, he spun her, placed the belt, and swam his length. Perfect, said Orla. Dave didn't respond. Later, at McDonald's, he didn't get her a McFlurry. It was Saturday, the final day of training. We'd written the theory test first thing, and the rest of the morning and afternoon was devoted to practicals. The timed lengths and endurance tests went off fine. Then, Nick wanted to give us a last demo of the core manoeuvres before lunch. Siobhan was playing dead, delighted to be in the arms of the only vaguely egalitarian male she'd ever met. And maybe it was hopes for her future, for the superior romantic prospects she'd find at UCD, that made her break character. Nick, your ring, she said. His face fell, but consummate professional, he finished the rescue before looking at his hand. There was nothing more affecting to our teenage company than a grown man who looked like he might cry. We peered into the pool, competing to find where the band might be suckered to a filter. "I see it," said Dave, diving to pull at a glint from a grate. He was under for the bones of 2 minutes before shooting up for air. "It's almost through," he said. "Careful, or it'll end up in the drain." Nick went down, resurfaced in near panic. "I'll go again," said Dave. Though she dove from the tower, she entered the water as a lap against the lakeshore, her element swallowing her, satisfied. The pool was so still we could watch the weave of her fingers, could see her hand find its angle, index curling under the gold to stroke it free, could see how she cradled the promise in the hollow of her palm till it ignited an arc up out of the water and returned to its keeper. She forgot to look shy. I knew she couldn't survive it. He told her he didn't want to get serious with anyone before college. She cried in my bedroom as we dissected the breakup. "He'd probably go after you now," she said. But he avoided us both. We all qualified as lifeguards. Nick was in charge of the roster at the pool, and he obliged the Orlas by putting us on the same shift when he could. It was a great summer. If we weren't on duty, we were messing around by the lake. There was no shortage of boys to pick us up when we punched out. Orla seemed to forget about Dave, went quiet if I talked about him, so I didn't. One day I took Colin sick and Dave was the standby. Orla visited me on her way home, brought a box of Maltesers and a copy of Cosmo. "I know this is going to sound like sour grapes," she said, "like he dumped me, so now I think he's a dick or whatever, but seriously." Two young lads had been fighting, and Orla dove to break it up. Afterwards, Dave told her she'd moved too soon. He'd had his eye on the situation because it was in his half of the pool. "His half of the pool," she said. "I don't remember the stay in your half of the pool rule, do you?" I did not. So, when she rang the next week to complain that Nick wanted her to cover for Emma but Dave was working, I said I'd do it. He arrived as I was opening up, asked how the summer was going. I knew from Siobhan that he'd been at the lake the night before and had taken Melissa Hughes for some kind of walk. He rubbed the back of his neck when I told him he'd a nice colour and smiled across the pool from his tower to mine before slipping behind sunglasses. When someone's drowning, it's not like TV. There's no splashing, no screaming. It looks like nothing at all. I stared at Dave, beautiful on high, his body alert but a droop to his chin. When someone is drowning, their mouth hovers at the surface and they bob vertical. They could be treading water, until you notice that their legs aren't moving and there's hair in their eyes. Dave's sunglasses were the mirrored kind, reflecting the window opposite him and the bodies below. Maybe drowning eyes are closed or glassy. Maybe drowning hands gently grasp at a ladder that isn't there. It's quiet. I glanced at the pace clock, trained my gaze on the blue and white wall opposite me, glanced at the clock again. I held my breath until I had to let it go. Dave didn't move. Why is our instinct, when faced with death by water, to curl in on ourselves as though our lives are secrets only we can guard? Dave's whistle blew. He jumped. I followed.
That was Emma O'Toole reading her own short story that was entered into the RTE Frances McManus competition, for which she was selected from 1,500 entries down to a final 10. And from the final 10, Emer was awarded third prize. Congratulations, Emer, and thank you so much for reading. Emer is from County Galway, outside of Galway City, and now lives in Montreal, where she teaches Irish theatre, film and performance at Concordia University. And she's written lots of non-fiction, including academic and newspaper commentary. And her book, Girls Will Be Girls, and that was published in 2015, is a funny, accessible introduction to gender theory, has been translated into 6 languages, and is continuing to write fiction and hoping to find a home for her recently completed first novel. Emer, a wonderful short story, and it must have been an honour, first of all, to be whittled down to the 10 and to be able to go to Ireland and to receive third prize in such a prestigious competition.
An enormous honour, and just, you know, any writer will tell you that with fiction, you're often kind of writing into the void, thinking, will anyone like it? Will anyone get it? Will anyone get it and also like it? You know, so you know, the acknowledgement of the work by the judging committee, you know, it just really helps you to continue. It's like a missive appearing from the inky dark of that void saying, yeah, please send some more writing into the void, please. So I guess I will.
Where did you get the yen to write? Because when I was at school, I hated, you know, you're sent home for the homework and write an essay. Where were you bitten by the bug to write?
I've always written and I've always read voraciously. And I think the writing comes from the reading. Like, I would read things and I think, oh, I could do that. And I would try to write little poems and you'd have a job to write a story or an essay, and I'd go way overboard and I'd spend the whole evening doing it. And then I wrote poetry in university, and then I got into blogging in the early days of the internet, and I think that was kind of essential for developing a voice, because part of writing is just, how do you make yourself sound like yourself? You know, what is your particular mode of communicating? And I think it was the blogging, really, that kind of low pressure, you know, daily or twice weekly or whatever commitment to creating something to be read by others, that helped me to kind of find a flow and a confidence in my voice. And then during my PhD, near the end of my PhD, I was writing for this group feminist blog called The Vagenda, which was a really funny kind of dissection of misogyny and sexism and silliness in popular culture. And then that got picked up by my writing got picked up by The Guardian, and then I ended up writing for The Guardian for about 8 or 9 years. And of course, like, I've always had the kind of academic stuff on the side, but I always kind of yearned to return to fiction, my first love, my true love. Because that's, you know, I'm in theatre studies, and I've also written some plays and kind of co-created plays and done all that stuff. But I always, like, when I come home in the evening, some people turn on the telly and I'm just always dying to get to my novel. It's my meditation and my, my time out of my own head, and one of the greatest pleasures in my life. And I think I always did want to get back to writing fiction. So weirdly, it was having the, you know, usually like the babies kind of shut down all your hopes and dreams, but mine, my babies were quite good for my hopes and dreams, because it's kind of impossible to do the commentary stuff, the stuff that I was writing for the Irish Times or the Guardian, because you have to put in a pitch and then you kind of have 24 hours to turn the piece around. And anyone who has kids will tell you that is just not possible. You cannot stay up till 3 a.m. finishing an article. And so I had a lot more kind of, I don't know, mental space to think about other things. And out of that mental space has come a number of short stories and a draft of a as yet unpublished novel. So I'll keep chipping away with it anyways, Austin.
I was chatting recently with Catherine Dunn. And Catherine has quite a lot of books out there. One of the things she said, there's a big difference between being a reader and a writer. And she found that out that when she loved reading, and she figured, well, if I'm a great reader, I can be a writer. And she found there's a huge difference. Would you concur?
I suppose it's different for every person. Like, I think certainly you can't be a good writer unless you read. The Margaret Atwood advice is read, write, read, write, read, write. I don't, I think a lot of people think they can just sit down and write their memoirs, but they don't actually do any, they don't actually read. And so the memoirs sound like, you know, they haven't developed the craft. So I think reading is the most important step in being a writer. But yeah, maybe it doesn't here. Okay. I'm going to get concise. Here's what I think. I think once you start trying to write, if you are a reader, you start looking at the writing differently. And then I think the reading does make you a good writer because you're like, oh, look what they've done with that sentence, or look what they've done with that dialogue, or oh, I really like the way I can hear the voice of that character in my head. How have they done that? And you start puzzling out the writing a bit more, and you also start to feel that like writerly jealousy of like, oh my God, that was good. Oh, I should give up. I'm never going to be as good as that. But you take all that inspiration and you weave it into your own work.
As a teacher of theatre, film, and performance, that's action. That's taking text and putting it into action. Writing is taking action and putting it into text.
Like they're very different art forms. Theatre is fundamentally a communal art form. So when, you know, when someone holds up a playwright as kind of an example of a great genius, okay, obviously those people exist. Like, you know, Brian Friel is a wonderful genius, but really would we know that unless he'd also assembled that extraordinary team of actors who put on translations for the first time? You know, it's theatre is communal. Doesn't matter what you write, the actor is going to interpret it in their own way. The director is going to interpret it in their own way. You're going to have scenographers who are going to create a visual frame for it. You're going to have people called dramaturgs who go away and do research that is then used on the production to kind of create a sense of a fuller world. It's and then write like writing fiction, on the other hand, writing short stories, novels, that's very solitary, and you have to do all that work in conversation with the only other creative partner, which is the reader. You never really know what that reader is thinking. Yeah, it's very different.
So, given that your day job has you in a communal environment and your night job has you in a solitary environment, is it a big transition?
Yeah, I hope I can always do both. Like at this point in my life, I can't commit to making a play because I'd have to turn up to the rehearsals, and one of my children will, of course, you know, pick that evening to pick up whatever gastro was going around the daycare. So I'm not in a position really to commit to a group project because of where I'm at, you know, as a parent. And so I have more time to develop that solo voice. But I still do little theatre things. Like obviously my students make theatre and I help them. And I run workshops at Concordia for anyone who wants to take a theatre workshop. So I'm still scratching that itch. It's not one or the other. I love both.
No, and where I'm coming from is that your talk, what you talk during the day, is you talk communal, you talk theatre, you talk film, you talk performance. So your mind space must be in that art form. And yet, your art form at the end of the day, when you sit down for your meditative time and your healing time, is solitary in a completely different art form.
Yeah, you know, I've never really thought about that before. You probably would have an alternative job as a therapist because that's actually very insightful. I've never thought about that before. Perhaps the novels are a kind of a kind of a meditative retraction from all of that dialogue, from all of those other perspectives, from all of the complications of society. And maybe they complement each other very well.
So, County Galway, now living in Montreal.
Tonight.
When did you come over?
2012, I think, or 2013. 2013,
And at that time, were the kids born here? Were they born there? Or they were born here?
They're born here. I met a Frenchman on the plateau in Montreal, which is what happens if you hang around on the plateau. You do just end up living with a French person. There's no way
Okay.
around. So, my partner's from France and I'm from Ireland, and we made little Franco-Hiberno babies who are Quebecois and Canadian, and we speak our own little Creole in our apartments that no one but us can understand. And yeah, it's a lovely place to live. Montreal's amazing.
Do you miss home?
I do. I miss it hugely. I miss
Does
it
your
hugely.
writing help you? Does your writing help you fill that emotional emptiness then?
Oh, I don't know. Sometimes it makes it worse. Sometimes it makes it worse because I'm like conjuring up places and people and voices. It's like, when the weather, there's like a very brief period here, just at the kind of in the middle of the autumn or the fall, as we call it, where the weather matches up to like an Irish autumn very briefly. And I always find it quite a difficult period to get through because I feel like I'm in two places at once. I walk out of the house and it feels like Ireland, the temperature, the smells, the dampness, the ambient dampness. And it does something to me sensorially where it kind of reminds me of home, and I'm always very homesick during that period.
And do you find then, if you're in a creative environment and mood at that stage, that your creativity is emotionally different than it would be at another time of the year?
Probably, actually, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought of that before either. Wow. I'm firing my therapist, and I'm just going to come to you to do an hour long interview every week. Is that all right? Yeah, that's probably very astute. I've just drafted another story, also with a kind of with in a teenage milieu that's very much in the kind of slightly cold damp of an Irish spring, and it came out of that same period. So that's, yeah, maybe I do. I think I do.
And when you mentioned that, actually, when you mentioned that you're writing another in teenage time period, would you say from your observations then that growing up in Ireland and being a teenager in Ireland and the experiences that you had as such would, from your observation, differ from what you see among teenagers in and around Montreal? Or is it just at a deeper human level that it's all the same?
No, it's not. I mean, it's an alien world. But also, there's the fact that, my teenagerhood is end of the 90s, start of the 2000s. So that's just very different to, like, I mean, I hang out with a lot of young people in there because I teach them. The youngest would be like 17. That's rare. People obviously take the classes as older people, but usually it's, kind of 18 to 24 is the people I'm hanging out with. They're amazing, and they're so self-actualized, and in touch with what they're feeling, and able to kind of state what they need. And I don't know. I'm blown away by them, really, by their confidence and their self-possession. And I had none of that at their age. I was just like, I forbade myself emotions. I think a lot of Irish people did. We're kind of tough. I drank like a fish, obviously. The young people today don't seem to be doing as much of that, certainly in Canada. And just kind of, I don't know, it was quite kind of, I'm being cruel to myself now because there was many great things about Little Lemur, but like was maybe kind of emotionally stunted, in a way that these Canadian young people are definitely not. And sometimes I find it a bit much, actually. Sometimes I find the emotion here and the openness with it and the kind of total lack of self-consciousness around it. I can find that difficult. It's overwhelming for an Irish person sometimes.
I have no doubt that some of these people, characters, will find their way into your work. with their emotional liberal being and in touch with themselves. We're going to have to wrap up because I do have to keep an eye on time. But Emer, it has been such a pleasure and such an honor, and congratulations. And I look forward to you and I keeping in touch as your work is published. And I say thank you so much.
Thank you, Austin, for this lovely conversation.